So let me start. How many of you guys use a binder other than KXLite? Yeah, good. Like at least half. So the other half of you, I'm going to go so far off label. I'm just saying that right up here as my disclosures and off label stuff that I have to report to the CME police, because none of this is a label. It's all off label. And like the talk before me, if you look at the heart failure labeled drugs, they're all off label what we do. Given nitrates for heart failure, given diuretics, it's where we are. Oh, so my disclosures, I've done research with every binder company, so I don't know which one I'm loyal to. There, Jim talked about there's a website, there's more than one. ASEP has the most recent one that we did, so if you're stuck in the ER trying to figure out what to do about hyperkalemia, it'll go there and help guide you through, because if you've forgotten the dose of calcium or something like that. And we'll get into those details in just a second. Yeah, you got to start with K. So here's PN. I don't know what those initials stand for, but it's a 59-year-old guy, and I see this guy all the time. He shows up in my ER because he's been in Vegas for the last week, and he forgot to take his drugs, and he didn't get his dialysis. And so guess what? He's short of breath, and he's probably not going to do well. And he doesn't look that terrible. I mean, he was gambling in Vegas this afternoon. So his vitals don't look awful. Those are his medicines. He hadn't been taking them either. And he is sitting there telling you he's a little bit short of breath. They always are a little bit short of breath. And I've also learned that hyperkalemia, they frequently present with chest pain, which sounds like their usual chest pain, and that's in no textbook I've ever read, but they seem to see it. And I will tell you, the reason I got involved in hyperkalemia is I was at Cleveland Clinic, and I saw it once a month. Not that often. I didn't think it was a big deal. I moved to Texas, and Texas is in the hyperkalemia belt. And the hyperkalemia belt is anybody who lives north of the border, because if you're in Texas, I mean, if you're in Mexico and you don't have insurance and you don't have a ton of money and you get renal failure, you're going to die sometime in the next 2 weeks. So they get into a pickup truck and they drive north until they come to some city that'll take care of them. And Houston, where I work now, is one of those cities where we'll take care of people. It's a remarkable thing. But so I see these people. I saw 30 a day when I first got there and said, we've got to do something about this because it's overwhelming us. And these are people who need emergency dialysis. 15 of them had potassiums of 7, and 15 of them couldn't breathe. And so we had to come up with some new answers. And so this guy looks like every other guy that I see all the time. He's short of breath because he hadn't been dialyzed in a week or two, and there he is. And so he's got rails, he's got a little edema, but none of this is awful. But what you got to do, what we do, is we have iStat, so we do the stat potassium, and all these people tell you I've been dialyzed in a while. And we do an immediate EKG, because if the EKG changes at all, you should now be nervous, because those are the people who arrest in the next 15 minutes. And I've seen a number of people try to die from this. Usually you can get them back, not 100% of the time, but frequently. And they get up their line, and they all get a chest x-ray, and they get the iStat. And so Peter gets his, and here's his EKG. And the nurses all make me sign these things because I'm supposed to write no STEMI. But when you see this, I don't care about a STEMI because this guy's got the ugly EKG and he's going to die soon. So you now have to pull the trigger. And while I'm getting ready to pull the trigger based on the EKG, this comes back. And anything more than 7, you should be scared. In the 6 range, you probably have some time to work. The idea that people who have renal failure get used to having hyperkalemia is bogus. It's not true at all. We've looked at over 1,000 patients in our database. If you have hyperkalemia, you have hyperkalemia. The fact that you got used to it is a fat lie. So if it's over 7, be nervous. And so what do? Here are the EKG changes. Now, the EKG is not a great tool. If it is negative, it means nothing. And there's plenty of literature on patients with potassiums of 7 or 8 with a normal-looking EKG. And there are people with 6.5 who have EKG changes. If they have the changes due to potassium, it is real. And if it's positive, it's real. But if it's negative, it means crap. So you're not off the hook if he hadn't been dialyzed in a week just because they don't have EKG changes. And this is the way they change. You know, it starts looking normal, and it gets wider and fatter until it's a sine wave. And the wider and fatter that the QRS is, the more you should be nervous. In the early period, you have those giant T waves, but it's hard to pull the trigger on that. But anything after that makes me really nervous. This is the causes of hyperkalemia. The big bad one is renal something. Either they're on dialysis or they just have bad kidneys. But that's almost probably 80% of what you'll see. There are other weird ones. Iatrogenic is certainly the next big one because we put them on a potassium supplement and they quit taking their Lasix and all of a sudden now their potassium's 8. And all the ones after that are small, rare, not too bad parameters. You can get yourself hyperkalemic with potassium, but it's really hard to do if you have normal kidneys because potassium is absorbed at the rate that you pee. So if you can pee, it will come in through your stomach, into your system at the same rate it goes out. So you can eat a lot of potassium, and you cannot. And the other part is it will make you vomit if you take a lot of potassium. So potassium overdose, I've never seen one where somebody tried to kill themselves with potassium because they just don't make it to the hospital. They don't get sick enough. But it's possible if you don't have good kidneys. So when I give hypokalemia patients potassium, I give it orally always because I know I can't hurt you. And I'll give huge doses, and you can give it until they puke. That's the limiting factor. So I'll give it IV and PO at the same time for when they're really bad. Pseudohyperkalemia is something you should worry about. We will see this. I've seen it numbers of times. It is not common. But when you see it, you can't treat it like it's hyperkalemia or you'll kill your patient. That's generally considered bad, so don't do that. What it is they have a bunch of cells they're not supposed to have. So it's a whole bunch of red cells, a whole bunch of white cells, a whole bunch of platelets. And these are not a little bit elevated. These are really elevated. So a white count of 100,000 something from CLL. And when that happens, those cells are fragile. And you suck it through the needle into your tube, they pop. And when they pop, every cell is basically a potassium bag. And it will let that loose. And so now what you have is this potassium. It's 11. And you go, holy crap, I've never seen an 11 before. Is the guy dead? They have no EKG changes because it is not the serum potassium. It's the intracellular potassium just popped when you did it. And so there's a whole, all the things you think about that cause elevated some kind of cell in your blood is the one that will screw up your reading. And when you have that, what do you do? Well, we always repeat it. And what happens when you repeat it? You get the same number again. You go, well, it must be true. And the answer is not true. It is not true because the patient's not dead. You don't have an 11. And so the trick to this is when you think you have one of these cellular instituted hyperkalemic events is you do the blood a different way. You don't suck it. You use a blood gas tube because it pumps it up there itself so it doesn't pop. You don't centrifuge it. Use some way to measure whole blood. That's usually a point of care medicine. And if you do that and you're gentle with it, you can usually find out the potassium is 4.5 and they have a white count of 111. So, but that's the trick. If you take somebody with potassium of 4.5 and give them a bunch of binders and you start giving them shifters, you know, albuterol and that sort of stuff, their potassium go to 2.5 and now you get somebody who's not happy at all. And I had a girl once with potassium at 2.5. She was flat out paralyzed, couldn't move. She could breathe, sort of, and that was it. I thought she had Guillain-Barré. I admitted her to neurology. Neurology thought she had Guillain-Barré, and then the potassium came back and it was like 2.5. I said, holy crap. I discharged her 6 hours later with a normal potassium. She'd been taking some crazy diuretic. It was called Mai Wang. It's a Chinese thing. She wanted to lose 15 pounds to get married and fit in her wedding dress, so she just titrated herself right out of potassium. Anyway, so this is what happens with hyperkalemia. It's a death rate on both sides of the fence. So normal is in the middle there. This is the same ICU study. It's in every hyperkalemia paper you'll ever see. There's two sides of it, though. It's a U. So low potassium is not so good either. High potassium is worse. You're going to die, and you're going to die soon. This is in-hospital mortality. This is not like I discharge them later. So and if you notice, the death rate starts to climb up in the five range. I discharge, my rule in my hospital is I can't do anything with somebody whose potassium is lower than 6. So I discharge 5.8s every day. And you can see a 5.8 has a mortality rate associated with it. So don't think you're done and just say goodbye, that you have to do something as an outpatient. Treat them, street them. Under 6 is what I do. But at that point, they need follow-up, and it needs to be soon because there's a death rate associated with this. This is a paper that Adam Singer. Adam, are you here somewhere? I know he's at the conference anyway. Oh, there he is, right there in the red. This is from Adam Singer's shop. This is ER. This is not ICU. The last one was ICU. This is looked at 100,000 patients who came in through the ER, and what is their deal? Well, anybody with a high potassium is going to die this visit, not next month. And so the higher it is, the worse it is. And you can see the cut point's right at 3.5 to 5. So you're above 5, you have a problem. It's not common to have low potassium. It was less than 5%. But the high potassium was only in 3.5%, but it still should make you nervous when you see it. All right, so what do you do? I got this ugly potassium, his renal failure. You knew that was the case. He's got a hemoglobin of 8. He's a renal failure patient. That's what they have. And a chest x-ray that shows a little bit of fluid. This guy's got EKG changes. You should give him calcium immediately. It's the best drug in the world. They go away. It's like treating hypoglycemia. You give them sugar, they wake up and say, hey, you give these guys calcium, their EKG changes, whoop, just like that. And it's going to last 30 minutes. And you know why? The reason it lasts 30 minutes because that gives you the time to mix up the insulin and glucose and give that to them. I used to give 10 units of insulin We did a study. We found out that 17% of those people had symptomatic hypoglycemia. So now we back down to 5 as our standard protocol. And if their sugar is already over 400, you can give 10. But you don't want to make them have a seizure while you're trying to treat their ugly EKG. And albuterol works really well. You don't even need an IV. You can plug them on. And in my shop, when COVID hit, we were not allowed to use aerosols anymore. So what do? You give them 5 puffs with an inhaler. It works just as well. Their potassium drops like a stone for about 2 hours, and then this is going to wear off. Same thing with insulin glucose. Doesn't change anything in terms of the potassium load. It just moves it from the plasma into the cells, where you can now buy some time to do the real thing, which is remove it from their body. Calcium does nothing to change the potassium. It doesn't shift it. It just stabilizes the myocardial membrane. So there's no point in giving it without EKG changes. But if they have EKG changes, calcium, insulin glucose, albuterol, and then if they pee, you can give them diuretics. Since most of these people are on dialysis of some form, that's a waste of time. But if they do pee, then it's a way out. So it's another thing to actually remove the potassium from the patient. This guy got ZS9, sodium zirconium cyclosilicate, and I can't say it, so I'm calling it ZS9, which was its original drug name when it was under development. It's just a lot easier to say. 10 grams PO. My feeling on this is that most of these companies underdose the dose of their binder. And the reason they did that, because this dose was meant to be used for a year. I don't give a much about a year from now. I'm worried about the next hour. So if you want to see things move, there are two binders out there that are new, ZS9 and Patiramer. They're all extremely non-toxic compared to K-Xlate. My nurses refuse to give a patient K-Xlate in my ER. They say, you know, he's just going to poop all over the place and it smells bad. I said, okay. So we give it in the elevator and they're going upstairs once they get admitted. My nurse is happy. But I've had patients flat out refuse it. They look at me and go, why do you want to give me diarrhea? Oh, come on. So I rarely use K-Xlate anymore. These new ones are much safer, and the other advantage to them is, first off, they work. They really remove the potassium from the patient. And after I've given my first load, so I've given them albuterol and insulin glucose and maybe some calcium, I give them the other binder. And the reason I do that is because in 2 hours when all those shifters wear off and they shift their potassium intracellular back extracellular, the binder's removed a bunch by then, and I quit having to redose them because they sit in my ER about 6 hours before I can get dialysis arranged. And dialysis is the ultimate end game here. So if I got to watch them for 6 hours, I mean, every 2 hours I have to draw their blood and then I have to go order some more drugs to treat their potassium, which has now started to climb up again. Or I give them a binder, a big healthy dose, right now when I first see them, and 2 hours later nothing changes and they're still low, and 4 hours later nothing changes and they're still low. So the binders don't change the game. I can always get the potassium down. It's just a question of how many orders do I have to write and follow. And that's the advantage of the binder, is that you can give it and get away from fooling around with them. And 2 hours later, the guy's 5.8, and in my shop, he goes home. Now, I would mitigate this and say, we don't know how long the binders will hold you down. That study has not been done. And so since I don't know, and I know that everything wears off eventually, maybe the binder wears off at home in 8 hours, and he gets sick and dies. So he's still on the hook here for dialysis in my shop. And that's what happened. This is Reveal. Reveal, Jim mentioned this a little bit ago. When we started doing the potassium research, we didn't really know what we did. And so I started asking emergency docs, what do you do? And it seemed to me that everybody had a different plan. So what we did is we did a survey and study. So this was a sort of a unique gig. What we would go to them, to the doc, and say, what do you do? They'd fill out a form, and then we'd watch what they did, and we measured the blood every 2 hours. So we found out what they did, what the effect of what they said they did, and whether it worked or not. And the endpoint was at 4 hours, what was your potassium? This is what we found out. Emergency docs had 144 different strategies. There were only 200 docs in the study. So it's crazy how many things are out there. But what we also found out is they all worked. And those are all the different things that everybody does. We found that the higher the potassium, the more you did. And it all worked. Everybody got the potassium down. Of all these patients, almost nobody died. And the ones who died were really sick with heart failure and ended up admitted and died 3 days later or something else. So we are good at managing this. It's just how much work it is. It's like blood pressure. I don't care how high your blood pressure is. I can control it. It might take me 9 drugs in 2 hours, but I will control it. And the same thing with potassium. So the whole point of this is to figure out strategies that are simple and will allow you to mitigate the disease without working me and my nurse to death. So these are the standard treatments that we have. I've talked about calcium. It lasts maybe an hour at most. My experience is 30 minutes. Insulin and dextrose, they work really well. It takes usually 15 minutes or half an hour to get it because my nurse has to mix up the insulin drip and give the bolus, and you know, we don't ever have that ready to go. Beta 2 agonists are great. They also work. They buy you a couple hours, and that's what you need to get the binders to work. Bicarb doesn't work really well. If they're not acidotic, what are you doing? The human body does not like to be alkalotic. You make somebody alkalotic, and what happens? They start breathing differently, and they fix their alkalosis. So the bicarb, if they're renal failure and they have a significant acidosis, is another option for shifting, but it doesn't last very long. And then you move into sodium polystyrene sulfonate, K-oxalate, sodium zirconium cyclosilicate, ZS9, or patiramer, the latter two being the other ones, the new ones. This is K-oxalate. So K-oxalate was approved in 1953. The FDA was not born until 1958. So the very first study on K-oxalate was 5 patients with renal failure and hyperkalemia. Only 2 of them died. And the summary was, this works pretty good. It's like, that's how I got FDA cleared. It grandfathered in. So it's not a great drug. And since then, there are a bunch of studies that show badness. And what badness is that you poop your brains out so you can have those kind of problems. But the other problem is your colon dies, up and dies. You get colonic necrosis because the K-oxalate crystals end up getting in the cells of the colon. And if you get colonic necrosis, you know what's going to happen. These were sick people to start with. About a third of them will die. So it's not a good drug from that perspective, and it's now got a black box. That's the black box that says you give it colonic necrosis and they'll die. I love this quote. It's from my mama, too. It says, if one has a black box warning and the other does not, choose the one that does not have the black box warning. So get away from K-oxalate. It's a terrible drug. So here are the new binders. This is patiramer. It's essentially plastic balls, 100 micron size, little tiny plastic balls. You take it orally. They just have to have a mouth. If they don't have a mouth, you can use an NG tube or some other way to get in, but it doesn't have an IV option. It binds potassium, so and now it goes out in the poop. It does not cause diarrhea. It just holds it stuck in the colon, which is a perfectly good place for potassium to be, and it doesn't swell. The reason that K-oxalate causes so much diarrhea is that when you give it orally, it then swells up to be huge later, and the colon knows it's got to go. Amethyst was a trial. It was meant to be a year-long trial of giving people who have chronic at risk for chronic hyperkalemia patiramer. And so they get the dose then. And these guys use doses that, like I said, are small. This is the year data. So you can see the potassium level comes down and stays down for a year. It works. It's safe. If any drug you can take for a year, you can certainly take in the ER for a little bit. But the problem is that I don't care about a year. This is what I care about, that little box right there, the first day. And look at the steepness of those curves. So at the dose they used, which was a dose of, I think, about 25 milligrams, it worked pretty well and kept you down. I usually use a double dose. It comes at 17 and a half, so I use 35 in my shop. You can do that safely. This is my anecdotal experience. It's not published. I still claim all these studies made their doses wrong for emergency docs, because they were planned for a year-long use, not for, you know, the 4 hours that I'm interested in. This is the reduced trial. This was done a single center, my shop, when we first wanted to know, does this drug work? Can we use it? Because we've got all these patients with hyperkalemia, I gotta do something with them. And so they would come in, they get 25 grams of patiramer, PO, open label, all of them had potassiums greater than 6, and we looked at what happened over the next 4 hours. And what we found out is over the next 4 hours, the potassium came down. It didn't matter whether you're placebo, because we had a placebo arm, or if you were the patiramer arm, they both came down. And if you look at these curves here, the steepness of the red curve is the patiramer group. Now, because this is a small trial, the groups are not well matched. So the placebo group had actually a higher potassium. So you can't look at the numbers of the potassium and say, oh ho, it works better, because it's not, the strength of the study does not support that. But what it does show you is it works. So the steepness of the curve in the red shows you that when you give patiramer and all your other therapies, that the potassium will come down. Now, the beauty of this, the people in the patiramer group had much less doses of albuterol and doses of insulin glucose, because you just don't need it. So it lowers your workload and the nurse's workload, too, because you don't poop with this. So that's the point of that study. So 25 grams is what has been published. That's what we did. The other one is ZS9, SZC. This is a cubic zirconium, and if you look at, there's a 3.1 angstrom hole in it where potassium fits perfectly. So it binds really tight to potassium. And the beauty of that is that it's the same as pteromer. It's now bound in the colon, and it actually starts binding in the duodenum. It's bound up in the lumen of the gut, so it's no longer in the serum. So in the old days when you used charcoal as to do the gastrointestinal dialysis, it's the same kind of thing, but for potassiums. It does not cause a lot of diarrhea. It binds about 150 times more effectively than K-oxalate, so it's a better binder, as you would expect. And it exchanges sodium for potassium. Now, that has some interesting issues with it. We'll get to those real quickly. These are adverse effects. These statistically no different than placebo. So it doesn't cause diarrhea. That's the big one. Some people get a little cramp here and there, but it's rare. What it does do that is unusual is peripheral edema, and it seems to be dose-related. So if you have a heart failure patient, could this be a problem? Yeah, in about 3 weeks. In the ER, I do not worry about this at all because I really don't care if you get a little tiny bit of edema and you don't die of your hyperkalemia. But if you're going to put somebody on it chronically, this is a yet-to-be-determined question about this drug. So this was a study. I went to the company before they were FDA cleared and said, do you have acute data? And they said, yeah, we do. I said, let me see it. They'd done their year-long 1,000-patient trial, and I had them pull out all the patients' potassium greater than 6 to look at how quickly it dropped. And it drops in about 4 hours. So there were about 60 patients. We published in the New England Journal. So you give them that tiny little dose, 10 grams, and their potassium will start to come down. Or you can give them 20 grams, and it comes down faster. And that's what we found out. These are, like I said, this is way off label. But this does work better than placebo and better, in my experience, than K-oxalate. This is the 1,000-patient trial, the 45 greater than 6.0. This is the time look. So at 4 hours, you can see the potassium has dropped by 0.7. So if you're 6.7, now you're 6. You can do the math on the rest. But usually 0.7 will get you to an area that you're comfortable with the patient hanging on and waiting until dialysis. And it seems to stay down for at least a 12-hour period. And after that, we don't really know. So these patients are still on the hook for dialysis. This is Bertha. 94-year-old lady, stage 4 renal disease, their eyes that way. She comes in. Now, her problem is, look at her heart rate. It's 40. That's a problem. She's got a pacer. Why isn't the darn thing working? So he called the EP doc, and he goes, if you start her on K-oxalate, she's not coming to my lab, because they don't know what to do with that. And so she gets her potassium dropped by the standard way, using the shifters. And then it comes down to 5.8, she goes to the lab, and she gets everything fixed in her pacer, and she gets discharged 2 days later. So that's the advantage of this. It's a cleaner, not so messy, well-tolerated couple new drugs. And they're not extremely expensive. I don't know what your hospital price is, but mine is what I would call reasonably priced if you're avoiding an admission. And I think I'm going to run out of time right here. Yeah, I got 2 minutes left. Anybody got any questions before I burn off the slides? The drug you have is a drug you have on formulary. And I'm not going to argue for either one predominantly, and the reason is there is no head-to-head data at all. The populations they've been looked at are different, but most hospitals will only have one on formulary, and we're ER docs. I always think it's hilarious when they're all worried about my disclosures because I'm going to somehow change the drugs my hospital uses. It's like, that's baloney. So I use pteromer at my hospital because that's what I've had for the last year. But we just got ZS9 on formulary, so at this point I actually have a choice, and my next choice is going to be which one's most expensive. And I don't know that yet for my hospital because I don't know the ZS9 price, but it's what you got and you can use. So rarely do our hospitals going to put both on formulary. Yes, sir. Oh, yeah. No, I have pharmacists too, but so you can give them a dose and you can give them another dose in half an hour. I have a pharmacist in the ER and she works with us pretty well. And I just show her the data and say, look at this. These are one-year studies. We're going to use, you know, we're not going to dose them every day, which is what the one-year study is, once a day. For somebody with potassium of 5.5, that's fine. But for my guy with a 6.5, I need to move it. And I've never actually had blowback from that. Yes?
So it seems like 80% of these patients, end-stage renal patients, come in 3 to 6 hours before their scheduled appointment.
Yeah. Yeah, so I don't know how long, you know, how long does it stick once I've got the potassium down. I know that all those shifting drugs wear off in a couple hours. We don't have the data on what a large dose of a binder does. How long does it last for in a hyperkalemia scenario? It's the missing study that hasn't been done. But here's what I do. I get their potassium down, and if they've got dialysis across town in 3 hours, I send them to dialysis. So I close the loop. I make sure there is dialysis somehow. And if I can't do that, I hold them in my ear until I can get it, because I just don't know what's going to happen otherwise. Alrighty. Next up, Michael Dick is going to talk about HIV.